Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You got your baby boom, you got your Gen X, Gen Y, and now Generation C. Demographics and the technological age on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 24th of February. And the word of the day this Friday is Generation C. C as in connected. The folks at Nielsen came up with it to describe 18 to 34-year-olds, those that are, Nielsen says, truly connected in the digital sense. We went out to the campus of George Washington University today in our nation's capital to see what some of those newly minted Gen Zers think about how they're being labeled.
The C could stand for a generation of consumers. You know, that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
I don't know that I think that Generation C is a good way to categorize us. I mean, everyone is more connected now. My grandparents are on Facebook, so.
We as a generation are clearly not labeling ourselves as anything.
Narrowing it down to Generation C and calling us all this one thing is about as thin as the connections that we have on things like Facebook and Twitter.
So deep thoughts from a college campus. But here's the thing. Nielsen is in the business of measuring things, trying to quantify our lives, whether it's what we're watching on television or how connected we are. So it kind of makes sense for them to come up with a term like Gen C. But what use is it really? For that, we've called Ian Schaefer. He's the CEO of Deep Focus. That's a digital marketing firm. Ian, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So I have to tell you, my first instinct is torn. I can't decide whether I want your professional opinion on Gen C or whether I should just say, come on, really, Gen C?
You know, this is, we, as a species, we love to label things. Sometimes we get more egregious than others. And in this case, that which we don't have a name for, we try to find a name for it. And, you know, labeling a demographic a certain generation based upon their behaviors seems like a natural thing to do because it's what we've done in the past. I think this time is different, though. I think, I think this whole notion of connectedness is more of a state of human evolution than rather a generational thing.
As opposed to baby boom born between 1945 and 1963 and Gen X.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've gradually moved from baby boomers, which are really a demographic, right, to progressively more psychographical terms. I think this is arguably just as much technographic as it is psychographic. We're, you know, rapidly merging with technology.
What does it do for you, this division, I guess, this labeling, what does it do for you as a marketing guy? I mean, is it helpful for you to be able to go after these people?
It will be helping PowerPoint presentations the world over. it will be, great search engine optimization. But I think it simplifies the notion that consumer behavior is changing. But I do think it's a little restrictive in the sense that if we think about it as a youth thing, or generational thing, we're doing a disservice to all of humanity. We're benefiting from the fact that, you know, everything is connected.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me there's a little bit of fallacy in the general premise, right? Because Nielsen, if I remember, broke it down 18 to 34, right, is the Gen
right.
C
right, block. Which is also what a lot of folks consider millennials or youth
right,
marketers.
Right, but here's the thing, right? If you're 34, 35, 36 years old, you're twice as old as somebody who's 18. And when I was 18, somebody who was 35 might as well have been dead.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of I think, you know, in order to make it accurate, the designation of Generation C, I mean, you have to cover several, actually, or at least maybe two generations. I mean, a 34-year-old could have an 18-year-old child. So, you know, that's a, you know, that's an issue at stake here with lumping them all into one category rather than, you know, again, speaking about connectedness as a state of evolution.
Yeah. How old are you?
I am 36.
Oh, so you didn't make
I
the
didn't
cut.
Make the cut, but I grew up learning how to code, so I feel like I'm an honorary member.
That's right. Ian Schaefer, he's the CEO and founder of Deep Focus. It's a digital marketing agency. Ian, thanks
a lot. Pleasure. Thank you.
On Wall Street today, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. In the end, not much of a change, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The long-rumored and long-delayed shrinkage of the United States Postal Service is finally going to happen. This week, the Postal Service said it's going to close more than 250 mail processing centers around the country. It's part of a $3 billion deficit reduction plan the post office says it has to do to survive. What's not going to survive, though, are a whole lot of post office jobs, including a lot of minority jobs. Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, here you are.
How are you?
I'm fine.
It's nice to meet you.
Same here. Have a seat.
These days, Nia Rice spends most of her days playing Farmville on her computer. But for 22 years, she worked for the post office. Raising two kids on her own, she considered herself lucky. For African Americans, working for the Postal Service in the 1970s was
the job to get if you could get it. It was the job to get.
That's because there were so few opportunities back then.
All the other jobs we had would be teachers, and that's about it. As far as, you know, the black was concerned. And if you didn't have your education, you couldn't be a teacher, and I didn't have the education for a teacher.
For the last few decades, the Postal Service has been a good place for minorities to work. Sally Davidow is a spokeswoman for the American Postal Workers Union.
Well, the Postal Service has always been one of the places where African Americans could find work because the Postal Service doesn't discriminate the way many private sector employers did in the past, and unfortunately some still do today.
Davidow says the cuts announced by the Postal Service this week are, quote, a disaster. In Alabama, three mail processing centers around the state will shut down and move here to Birmingham. Similar consolidations are happening nationwide. In the end, about 35,000 jobs will be lost. L.D. Brown started working for the Postal Service 22 years ago. She says back then, it was an easy decision.
Now you can become a federal employee. You look at the benefits that it had to offer.
For many African Americans, a job at the post office was a way to enter the middle class.
When I started at the Postal Service, there were many blacks, and majority of the managers were black. So upward mobility was always around.
That's part of what drew Derek Thompson to the job. He's been delivering mail for about 10 years.
You might want?
No, it's a beautiful day.
Before this job, Thompson was a cop. He didn't like it. Too much sitting around, he says. Coming to work for the Postal Service was definitely a good move.
It's a lot better. I mean, I've been able to make it a lot better than I would have as a police officer.
Money-wise?
Money-wise, yeah. Money-wise and benefits-wise and everything else.
And even with the shakeup, he has no plans to start looking for another job.
This is where I intend to stay, unless, of course, I don't have a choice.
In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
No sooner was it announced on Monday than doubt started being raised about the Greek debt deal. You throw in the president's tax plan, Dow 13,000, and we, ladies and gentlemen, we got ourselves a segment. Wrapping the week with us today are Felix Salmon from Reuters, also Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Gentlemen, good tidings.
Hey, Kat.
Good afternoon, Kai.
Good afternoon. All right, so Felix, we'll start with you, actually, and Greece and
My favorite subject.
I know. You've been writing about it all week. Today's the day, right, when the actual exchanges of debt start to happen.
No. We had a press release today, and it was a kind of fill-in-the-blanks thing. They said, we will release the numbers at some unspecified point in the future, but at least we have an official release. They said it's all official, but it's going to happen now.
Well, but I thought the whole thing was a little shaky still. Are you really buying this press release?
Well, the press release is, you know, it lays out most of the details of the exchange. Most of it we knew already. What it does is it makes it official that they're going to put out the exchange offer. What they can't do is guarantee that enough of the bondholders are going to take them up on their offer that will actually happen.
Right. So Cardiff, we had a Greek bondholder on the broadcast on Tuesday, Hans Humes from Greylock Capital Management, a big hedge fund. He owns Greek debt, and I asked him whether this was really voluntary or his arm was being twisted, and he said, you know, we sort of knew what we were getting when we got into it, so we're going along with it. Where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, we have to wait to see if it works, and we have to wait to see if enough bondholders actually participate in this thing that it'll go through. My best guess, and that's all it is because who knows what will happen in the next 2 weeks, is that under the loosest possible definition of the word work, it'll work and we will end up, and things will end up working out, and we will proceed with the bailout before that big March 20 date. Now, that doesn't mean that anything's really solved. It just means it's been postponed, and we can talk about that. But I think my best guess is that, it'll happen.
Well, wait, Felix, hold on. Let me get Clintonian on you here and ask you what the definition of work is. What is it? What's it going to look like if this thing does work and then doesn't?
Okay, well, if it works, then the first thing, which is a big thing, is that 200 billion euros of Greek debt will be cut by 70%. The bondholders will, Greece will have only 31 cents outstanding of new debt for every 100 cents outstanding of old debt that it had. So it will have wiped out 140 billion euros of debt at a stroke. So that's definitely useful in terms of getting a country's debt down. And that's basically all that the private sector bond exchange can ever be expected to do.
Mm-hmm. But Cardiff, if it doesn't work, we're back to square one.
Well, we are, but actually it's worse than that because at that point there won't be enough time satisfy all the demands for the bailout that's coming. Then we're really in trouble.
If it doesn't work, then it's a disaster because if it doesn't work, then you have a chaotic default which no one has prepared for and probably Greece would be forced to leave the euro. It would be very, very bad.
I don't understand what's worse than square one, like square negative 12, but anyway. so let me go to a question that I asked Carney and Sudeep Reddy last week about the overall state of our economy. Let's get away from Europe for a minute. And what I wanted to know from those guys was things are going well. Dow's at 13,000. People are feeling better. But what is it that we don't know about that's going to bite us in the fanny, to choose another word for that? Felix, what's going to get us?
Well, it could be Greece. If Greece goes badly, then that will spill over to the rest of the world.
Greece doesn't count. You have to come up with something else.
I have to come up with a different option?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Cardiff has a good idea.
Sure. I mean, there could be a few things. I think that fundamentally the U.S. economy is in better shape than it was early last year. But you certainly want to talk about gas prices. Mm-hmm. I think we're better equipped to handle them, but that's something to look out for. Another one is just another policy error. These things happen all the time. We're still facing a certain amount of fiscal government drag this year. And I don't know. It's one of these things where you can't really anticipate the unanticipatable
to make up a word.
So, but another one is just that some of this is another false start and that there are seasonal trends that haven't been picked up. I'm more optimistic than I have been in a while, to be honest.
One of the reasons why we're so optimistic right now is because we've had a pretty healthy run of good jobs numbers.
Yeah.
And so people are looking at the, improving jobs numbers and saying things are going well. But this is a statistical series with a lot of noise in it. And when you have a run of good numbers, you can easily have a run of bad numbers. And then we'll be much more pessimistic than we are right now.
So let me quickly wrap up with one-word answers from each of you. Are you actually, Felix, optimistic, yes or no?
Yes.
Cardiff?
Yes.
All right, good, good. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Felix Salmon from Reuters. Guys, enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, thank you.
Coming up,
you can't throw a rock in California without hitting an animator, or somebody else kind of in that field.
You want to make movies? Why not Louisiana? But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, it was almost Friday, the 13,000. The Dow Industrials crossed that level again, but couldn't hang on. The Dow gave back a point, basically flat, closed at 12,982, oh so close. The NASDAQ picked up 6 points, 0.2%, finished at 2,963. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.1%, ending things at 1,365. That is, by the by, its highest level since June 2008, which, need we really remind you, was before the financial crisis. For the week gone by, the Dow gained 0.3%. S&P 500 did the same. The NASDAQ just a little bit better, inched up 0.4%. Upbeat consumer sentiment figures juice stocks in the morning, but rising oil prices sapped the rally. Crude closed, by the way, at like $109. FedEx slipped nearly 2% as higher fuel prices hit transportation stocks. Quarterly corporate reports produced some of the day's biggest winners. Orient Express Hotels jumped 12.5%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.97%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Mobile World Congress kicks off in Barcelona. It's all about, what else? Mobile technology. 60,000 attendees are expected. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for January. And a House Natural Resources Subcommittee holds a field hearing in Steubenville, Ohio, to talk about natural gas. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We passed an educational milestone last year that went largely unnoticed, mostly because the census data only came out this week. For the first time, more than 30% of adults in this country have at least a bachelor's degree. Even though 30% doesn't actually sound like a lot, it was a big step forward. What's less clear, though, is why advocates of higher education aren't making a bigger deal of it. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
In 1947, when the census started keeping track, just 5% of American adults had a college degree. Even 15 years ago, it was less than 25%. Sarah Goldrick Rabb teaches education policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says a big push to get more people to go to college has paid off.
There's widespread awareness that without some form of post-secondary education, it's very unlikely that you will be able to reach and or stay in the middle class.
College-educated people also weathered the recession better with much lower unemployment rates. But Goldrick Rabb says while more people are going to college, not enough of them are finishing. Just over half of full-time students at four-year colleges graduate in 6 years.
We have focused all of our energies on getting people to go, and we haven't figured out all the keys to success.
Especially for low-income and Black and Latino students who still lag behind their white and Asian American peers. Stan Jones is president of the nonprofit Complete College America.
We have a more representative freshman class in the country than we ever have. But the graduating class that stands on the stage doesn't look at all like that freshman class.
Jones says rising college costs are part of it, but he also says colleges need to do a better job with remedial classes and helping students get on a clear path to graduation. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You know how a lot of times when you buy something at a department store, you're offered a discount if you sign up for a store credit card? You say yes, the store gets all your shopping data. You say no, the store's out of luck. Bloomingdale's is trying to change that equation a little bit. Next week, it's going to start offering a loyalty card that's not connected to a credit card. It's kind of like a grocery store card, and you should get yourself ready because more of them could be on the way. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that story.
Vincent Kwan is a professor at New York's Fashion Institute of Technology. He's also kind of a super shopper and a man who knows his loyalty cards.
Honestly speaking, I got probably practically one from every major department store.
There's also the supermarket card, a Costco card, and of course, a bunch of drugstore cards. Kwan says in this competitive market, Bloomingdale's needs all the business it can get, so the exclusive department store is becoming a bit more inclusive.
They possibly could be lowering their bar and trying to capture what they can with regards to the consumer that's spending.
Anthony Chikumba of BB&T Capital Markets says Bloomingdale's and other department stores are trying to wean shoppers off discounts by offering them rewards instead.
This is a way that Bloomingdale's can try to drive incremental purchases without, you know, constantly having to dangle that carrot of 30-40% off.
Loyalty cards can also help Bloomingdale's reach customers who don't have its credit cards and target them with special offers.
In the world of high-end retail, consumers want to be treated as though the retailer knows them.
That's Joel Bynes, a managing director at Alex Partners. He says we can expect to see more of these cards, to which Vincent Kwan says,
you know, your wallet's only yay big.
Are you listening, Bloomingdale's? Kwan needs reward points to buy a bigger wallet. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down.
write myself a letter.
A couple of days ago, Stephen Dubner and I were doing some Freakonomics about the positive correlation between office morale and productivity. One goes up, so does the other. But what does negative morale even look like? I asked. Apparently, you can tell by the way people park. Backing into a space means you hate your work. You want to get the heck out of there. Jack Parker of Danvers, Mass. says not where he works.
We have like a shopping mall parking lot, so everybody just naturally face your cars out. No, we don't have that sort of frustration.
The ultimate telltale sign of bad morale, though, is absenteeism. Dubner and I talked about the Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, in the shorthand. It's the federal law that lets employees take time off for certain family and medical reasons. Nancy Yedlin from New Haven, Connecticut, wrote to say that I framed it the wrong way.
You don't just come into work one day and say, oh, by the way, I'm taking tomorrow off and I'm using FMLA. There's a process, there's criteria. And it's not paid time off.
Finally, Greek yogurt. Ben & Jerry's now has four new flavors on the market, as I remarked the other day, while also innocently wondering aloud what it is about Greek yogurt that's got everybody all excited anyway. Ramona DiViola from Berkeley, California says, are you kidding me?
Clearly have not tried this luscious delight. My first taste of Greek yogurt was ironically in Greece. And since then, I've sought it out at Shishi Gourmet Shops, and bypassing the chocolate, cheese, and wines from around the globe just to buy that yogurt.
Two things. One, I have tried it. Take mine with a little bit of honey, to be honest with you. But also, I bet actual in Greece Greek yogurt is way different. If you want to talk food, write to us, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Sunday brings us the Academy Awards, putting the glamour of Hollywood firmly in the spotlight. The other 364 days of the year, though, the movies are a business that everybody wants to get a piece of. 40 states offer film production tax credits, trying to draw producers and studios and the trickle-down effects of a big-budget motion picture. Louisiana, though, took a slightly different approach. The Bayou State was the lead investor on a film, one that just happens to be nominated for an Oscar. Kate Archer-Kent from Red River Radio reports.
Jobs in Louisiana revolve around oil and gas, chemicals, shipbuilding, but not film animation. So a few years ago, the state took a chance on an animated short film that would be made entirely in Louisiana.
We knew we were taking a bit of a risk in this case.
That's Stephen Morey, Louisiana's Secretary of Economic Development. He wanted to show off Louisiana's creative talent, so the state gave seed money to open an animation studio in Shreveport. It's called Moonbot Studios. The state shelled out nearly $700,000 for the studio's first film. The 15-minute film is titled The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. It's a wordless, whimsical story that portrays the power of books. Morey says with an Oscar nod, Louisiana hit the jackpot.
Our great aspiration, our vision for this entire project, from the state's perspective, was that this would become a very unique and compelling marketing tool.
Moonbot Studios says it's been able to recruit young, ambitious computer animators to Shreveport. Here's the company's managing partner, Lampton Enox.
Really, the state kind of opened the spigot for us. It gave us enough money to make some strategic hires to start really planning out what we needed to do for the film and for the company.
Bevan Blocker was hired fresh out of art school in Florida. He's one of several dozen animators who stayed on after the film was completed. Blocker says sometimes Shreveport feels a little too small town. He wishes it had the nightlife and creative energy of a city like San Francisco.
It's kind of a mixed bag in a way.
After all, he does have an animation credit on an Oscar-nominated film. Blocker's only 25 years old, and he says it's unlikely he'd get this opportunity at a large Hollywood studio so soon in his career.
You can't throw a rock in California without hitting an animator, you know, or somebody else kind of in that field, and I don't think we're there yet.
But Louisiana's Stephen Morey says these tax credits have created hundreds of new jobs.
The jobs are being created so quickly, we're struggling a little bit to keep up with demand, you know, for talent.
So is propping up the industry worth the investment? Cornell University professor Susan Christofferson studies how states use incentives to lure film projects. She says doling out millions of dollars to producers each year isn't a prudent way to spend public money.
Louisiana can be in this for the long haul, but that means that Louisiana taxpayers are going to be subsidizing this industry for a very long time.
Christofferson says even if the state is a location for a film shoot, often the post-production is done back in California. Louisiana is trying to stop this migration by showing producers it has the workforce to get the job done. For now, at least, Moonbat Studios plans to hire about 15 more animators this year. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we say to Mitt Romney's campaign advisors, we feel your pain. I don't know that you can campaign for president without actually saying anything, but you have to believe Romney's staffers are wishing it were an option. First, there was that $10,000 bet with Rick Perry in the debate a couple of months ago. And then today, in a speech in Detroit, there was this. Romney was extolling the virtues of the American automobile industry. He said he drives a Mustang and a Dodge pickup. His wife, Ann, she drives Cadillacs. Two of them. All right, that's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Today, the Dow gave back a point. We'll call that basically flat. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 added 2 points. That is 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, putting money away for retirement is a lot like exercising.
You're not going to get that immediate satisfaction, but in the long term, you're going to really get a big reward.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have a good weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.